Well, hello. My name is Andy Gould, and I'm a lecturer in environmental policy here at the LSE. And I'm very pleased to be chairing this session of the LSE Environmental Initiatives Network. Our speaker today is Bishop Hugh Montefiore. Hugh's had a varied life. He served in the army and after the war became ordained and moved on to become the Bishop of Kingston upon Thames and also later the Bishop of Birmingham. And aside from those interests, he's also been heavily involved in a range of different environmental campaigns. He was chairman of Transport 2000 and has had interest in a range of transport and environment-related issues and groups. And is also chairman of the Friends of the Earth Trust. This is a trust linked very closely to the main campaigning arm of Friends of the Earth and manages its membership and other aspects of its activities. 4 or 5 years ago, Friends of the Earth published a very influential report called Sustainable Europe. And then after that, a book called Tomorrow's World, which is what he will be speaking on today. That book and that report focused on really the space that should be made available for economic activity and for life, and tried to provoke a debate about how we might define some limits for those activities, and whether those limits should constrain economic life and make space available, but also focus very much on how that space should be used most effectively and most efficiently. It's difficult to determine exactly what impact that book has had, but I think it's fair to say that in many areas of policy now, those ideas are certainly viewed much more sympathetically than they were 5 years ago. So these issues are very relevant in policy terms and have been informing policy debates in all sorts of areas. So we're very pleased to welcome Bishop Hugh Montefiore today, and I'll hand over straight to him.
Thank you so much for your introduction. I'm talking about sustainable development, and as you rightly say, from this book, Tomorrow's World, published by EarthScan, 1998. I'm afraid it's 1295. First, let me say that when I use the phrase sustainable development in Tomorrow's World, I'm referring not to sustainable development in one particular country, but in the planet as a whole. I would define the phrase sustainable development as meeting the needs of the present in such ways as to enable future generations to meet their own needs. That's what I'm going to talk about. Secondly, I must explain I'm not an economist, I'm not a geographer, I'm not a politician, I'm not a professional environmentalist. For the last 50 years, I've been passionately concerned, however, about our physical environment. I'm simply an antique retired bishop, and if you ask why on earth should a bishop be concerned with such a subject, I would reply that planet Earth maybe is, I would say probably is, unique among an unknown number of planets which circle billions of stars in our universe. Unique in that it has developed Gaia, a living environment, biosphere. This in turn has given rise to intelligent beings. As I believe it, this is part of God's plan. And the possibility that mankind, by abuse of our environment, may render this wonderful gift of God uninhabitable or may prevent future generations from meeting their essential needs, this is almost too terrible for me to contemplate. Indeed, as I understand, it's a grave sin against God, so that I do what I can, which isn't very much, to try to prevent this happening. However, that's by way of explanation. I'll now get on to my subject. I don't think it will take much convincing an audience such as you that at the moment our use of material resources is unsustainable. We are depriving future generations of their birthright. What is more, sustainable development can only be achieved if irreversible deterioration of our environment is halted. In the words of the United Nations Environmental Programme, sustainable development means improving the quality of life while remaining within the carrying capacity of supporting ecosystems. Way back in 1972, the Brundtland Report issued its famous statement on behalf of the Commission of the Environment and Development and brought a larger perspective to the matter. It defines sustainable development as meeting twin needs, protecting the environment and alleviating poverty. It's important to bear both these in mind. If our development is already unsustainable, in many areas this is the case, we have to bear in mind that this is because the developed world has been using most of the material resources, leaving much of the rest of the planet in poverty. What is more, that poverty is increasing, not only between the have and have-nots in this country, but more importantly, between the countries of the north and the countries of the south. Unless something drastic is done, what will happen? What on earth will happen when China and the developing countries and developing world catches up with us and follows, and the south follows in the steps of the north? The answer is global catastrophe. The average rate of extinction of species today is 50 to 100 times the average. We are now in the sixth great extinction. The first five were due to natural causes. The sixth is man-made. Currently, humanity takes 40% of the natural primal productivity on land, 25% on sea. 13 out of our main fishing areas now have depleted stocks. Two-thirds of developing cultures use wood as cooking for cooking and heating fuel. The gap between supply and demand is widening. Despite recent floods, fresh water, strangely enough, is becoming scarce. The United Nations Environmental Programme reports unsustainable use of land, forests, urban air, often beyond renewable capacity. Outputs of economies, too, are also unsustainable. Human pollution and waste are affecting the global environment, and so are those of animals, cattle. We are suffering from climate change, ozone depletion, acidification of the soil, and so on. These are all now subjects of international debate. Desertification is claiming ever-increasing areas of the world. There is some uncertainty about the effects of global warming, but the precautionary principle should apply that we do nothing that obviously endangers future generations. The present emissions of carbon dioxide are already beginning to cause weather turbulence, as we can see in Mozambique, and also causing rise in sea levels. And now we hear it is also contributing to the thinning of the ozone layer. Sea levels are due to rise 50 centimetres, they've already risen 6 centimetres, and a result, when they rise 50, that will double the present area that is subject to flooding. The Maldives Islands are confidently expected to become uninhabitable in the next century. We here in the United Kingdom are likely to be affected not by a rise in temperature, but by a drop in temperature, as the melting of the ice caps will cause the warm water currents we know as the Gulf Stream to sink below the surface, and our climate may well be that of Greenland today. We are relying on single varieties of crops in order to increase present output, but if there is environmental change, climatic change, we shall need diversity. What is needed is to reclaim sustainable development, not just local self-sufficiency, because now we have globalization, so that our food and other goods can come from almost anywhere in the world. What we need are clear global limits that must be maintained by sustainable management techniques. And the free market must be restrained, because when it is left on its own, it produces environmental degradation of those countries in the world which are least able to counter them. So far, I have concentrated on the word sustainable, but the noun development is equally important. The poor countries of the world are desperately in need of development. In the last 30 years, inequality worldwide has doubled. One quarter of the world's population, 1.3 billion people, live in poverty. The North, with another quarter of the world's population, consumes one half of the total of all fossil fuels, two-thirds of all metals, three-quarters of industrial wood products, much more than our fair share. OECD countries with 15% of the world's population alone exceed the global estimate of the sustainable level of carbon emissions for 2050. If China were to catch up with the OECD, that country alone would be responsible by 2050 for twice the sustainable level of carbon emissions. The emissions from richer countries must be so restrained that the poorer countries have their fair share. We do not have the right to appropriate resources that other societies need now and will need in the future for their sustainable development. Nor can we forget the past. If we consider the period between 1860 and 1968, the United Kingdom ranks third in carbon emissions. So that we in this country are to that extent responsible for global warming. Let me quote from a UK government publication published in 1999 called A Strategy of Sustainable Development for the UK. It reads, quote, "Although the idea is simple, the task is substantial. It means meeting four objectives at the same time in the UK and in the world as a whole. Social progress, which recognises the needs of everyone, effective protection of the environment, prudent use of natural resources, and maintenance of high and stable levels of economic growth and employment." That's a lot. How are we to decide? How are we to decide what is fair shares for all? I put to you that there is only one fair way of doing it. That is to take the total sustainable capacity of the planet, of the various resources, to divide that by the total population of the world, to find out thereby what are the per capita sustainable limits that each of us can use of these resources. We then multiply that by the population of the country concerned to find out what each country should be permitted to consume. In the jargon the experts use, we shall then discover what is our environmental space. Then and only then can we have really global sustainable development. If we do not have that, there will in the end be catastrophe. Obviously, this needs to be done by countries on a world scale. Why should the UK go it perhaps alone? The answer is that unless the developed countries take a lead in cutting their consumption, there is no hope in the world of persuading the developing countries to have regard to environmental constraints. And unless a major country like the UK takes a lead, other developed countries are unlikely to follow. It will take the developing countries some time to catch us up. So we should be looking ahead, I think, about 50 years to complete our reductions in consumption. We shall need to meet interim targets for 2010 if we're ever going to meet our final targets for 2050. There will be those who object that countries that have high birth rates do not deserve such good treatment. And those countries which have in the past discovered modern technologies for increasing productivity ought to benefit thereby by a larger consumption of resources. I take those arguments. But the people in countries with large birth rates did not actually ask to be born. They found themselves born into an unfair world. It is surely a basic human right that everyone everywhere should have an equal opportunity of access to resources needed to live a decent life. I think we have a clear moral duty to see that this is the case. Limiting outputs does not necessarily mean limiting well-being, because happiness is something very elusive. It does not depend on the ever-increasing standard of living. We could maintain our present standard of living and also reduce consumption. There is a vast unexploited potential to adopt efficiency measures to improve environmental capacity and productivity. Much of this is actually financially cost-effective, e.g. renewable energy resources, combined heat and power engineering, and so on. Moreover, environmental measures would actually give increased employment opportunities, putting these into practice. There is a growing consensus among leading business interests that by the first half of this century, we need to reduce our consumption of environmental resources by 10%. And the same business leaders are confident that with the right regulatory framework and with effective market mechanisms, they can deliver such improvements. We must put an end to the present situation whereby industry creates the wants that it then seeks to satisfy. Our present overconsumption is not limited to food, though growing obesity shows that food is certainly involved. We need to recognise that we have enough and we must avoid overconsuming in a way that will damage our own best interests. As the United Nations Environmental Programme put it, the inefficient use of resources and the patterns of material consumption are driving us towards an environmental precipice. Conventional approaches to economic growth and increasing material consumption are no longer delivering in the North increases in well-being. The USA, despite its ever-increasing GDP, has a decline in 16 acknowledged indicators of well-being. I'm not concerned tonight with political measures that are needed to put what I've said into practice, nor am I concerned with the international regulatory bodies that will be required. I'm only concerned with raising public awareness of the need for sustainability. As governments, which have only a five-year term of office, are unlikely to have strong measures over the long-term survival of populations on the planet, unless they are forced to do this by government by public opinion. National and international politics are, of course, of crucial importance, but within my time allotted, I leave them on one side now. In the remainder of this talk, I'm going to ask the question, so far as the UK is concerned, is it possible for us to keep within our own environmental space without loss of development? The fact and arguments that I take you are mostly taken from this book, which I mentioned. I've been inspired by the arguments there, and the bulk of what I have to say comes from that. We do not inherit the earth from our parents, we borrow it from our children. That's the present situation in which we live. We must have and continue to have an ozone layer, tropical forests, clean air, water, and a stable climate for us, for our culture and civilization. What rate of resources is sustainable? Assume that by 2050 our UK population will be 59.9 million. How do we set about determining our limits? First, we must determine the sustainable global amount of each resource, estimating the annual rate of use which we must reach to avoid breaching that constraint. As I said, we then calculate the per capita share in environmental space, assuming that by 2050 there will be 10 billion people in the world. We then calculate the UK target, assuming that in 2050 our population will, as I say, be 50.9 million. We then estimate current UK consumption, taking account of trade in that resource, that is to say, the energy of both imported and exported products. We can then calculate the percentage of reduction needed by 2050 in the UK. And since this is half a century away, we better calculate the interim target for 2010. We can then examine the major ways in which resources used in order to identify potential savings by efficiency and strategies for using substitute resources. To that I now turn. And I start with energy. Fossil fuels are the source of 85% of carbon dioxide globally. It takes 1 million years to produce 1 year's present global consumption of oil. Oil and gas resources were likely to be exhausted by 2050 or too expensive to extract. If we leave things as we are, temperatures will rise by up to 3 degrees centigrade by 2100. The IPCC, the climate control people, tell us that current emissions of CO2 need to be cut by half by 2050 so as to reduce climatic change to an acceptable limit. If the UK reduces its emissions to that which is compatible with our own environmental space, this will mean a reduction of 88% using 1990 emissions as the base rate, with an interim reduction of 22% by 2010. Question I ask, is this possible without any reduction of development? And I answer, yes, yes, it is possible. I disregard nuclear energy because, after all, even though it's emission-free, because it's uneconomic, the cost of commissioning reactors on decommissioning reactors on a large scale is crippling. The problem of disposing of high radioactive waste is unsolved, to say nothing of the increased danger of accidents if many more reactors are built. Anyway, many of ours will be past their sell-by date by 2050. At the moment, the non-fossil fuel obligation is only 6% of all energy in this country. Wind-generated electricity is now down to 4p per kilowatt-hour, which is twice that of gas. But it will fall further as more windmills are built. By 2010, we could produce 10% of our energy by this means and 33% by 2050. That would mean 22,000 turbines instead of the present 500, if people can wear that. The price of photovoltaics has dropped from $80 per watt in 1975 to $4 today, and will drop further if mass-produced. Already 42,000 solar heating systems have been fitted in this country, and the owners say they produce about half of their hot water. The scope is enormous. If 50% of all the houses in the UK were fitted with solar water heatings, up to 15 million tonnes of carbon dioxide would be saved. Well, between 4 and 15, the range is great because there are many forms of solar heating which you can have. By 2050, on a conservative estimate, 20 to 50% of current electricity demands could be generated in this way. Political intervention will be needed here, as in so many fields. In Japan, half of nuclear energy installation costs are given by government subsidy. The European Union has agreed that 15% of all energy by 2010 should come from renewables. That's rather conservative. Probably sensible in light of what's happening in the rest of Europe. But 2050 could be more than 100%. Half of all energy is consumed in your domestic housing. 40% of these costs could be saved. And in the long run, perhaps 90%. Combined heat and power systems are 90% efficient compared with the 55% of your gas fires. Efficient fridges could save 70%. But alas, UK standards are very low. There are large potential savings from loft insulation, cavity walls, double glazing, draft proofing, condensing boilers, cylinder insulation, low energy lights, and efficient freezers and cookers. A package of measures for a household estimated by the government to cost between £1,079 and £2,090 can save up to £580 annually for the householder, and about 60% of the average annual emissions in a house of carbon dioxide. That is from the energy it uses. As for new houses, we do have energy efficiency standards in the UK, but they are very feeble. A new house in Scandinavia, where it is, I think, colder than the UK, consumes only 30% of the energy of a new house built in this country. However, there is the so-called Lower Watts house in Oxfordshire, adopting Scandinavian insulation and airtightness to UK building methods, which costs no more than other houses cost to build, while energy costs are reduced by 22 to 35%. Great scope for the reduction of CO2 here, if we got down to it. Especially as we are told that some 4 million new dwelling houses are needed. Well, we have been told that, even if we haven't believed it. As for non-residential houses, buildings, consumption could greatly drop here. If you go to Jarrow, you could find the Groundwork Eco Centre, which uses only 20% of the energy of a normal air-conditioned UK office. It uses various means like body heat to heat it all. Costs should drop by two-thirds by 2050 if we set about it. And consumption by industry should fall by an equal amount by 2010. contributing to a lower cost of production. Tell you, the benefit of industry to do this. I turn to transport. Well, transport. Cars produce 23% of our emissions of carbon dioxide, to say nothing of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide emissions. These are not reduced. CO2 emissions from cars alone will exceed our environmental space of CO2 by 2050. But alas, our Chancellor, as you know, has bowed to popular opinion and has cancelled the petrol escalator, which he had earlier introduced. So it'll be interesting to see what he says in the coming budget. Reduction of car use now seems to be thought of only in terms of traffic congestion. But the increasing carbon dioxide emissions are far more pressing. What can be done? Well, I can only produce the well-worn answers, modal shifts needed from road to rail, from private car to public transport. But few steps are being taken to produce bigger and more comfortable buses. And as for trains, they have already increased the number of passengers by 6%. The rail networks are used so much that there's not all that scope for more trains. But trains in themselves cannot solve the problem of carbon dioxide. A great deal could be done in increasing the fuel efficiency of cars, if only there was pressure to do this. At present, the average is 36.7 miles per gallon. Did you know there is a car that can do 100 miles per gallon? But not, of course, on the market, because that would need huge investment costs, which our manufacturers will not make. Why should they? Unless there is strong pressure, violent pressure on them to do so. The Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution has proposed 40% improvement by 2005 in 5 years' time. I'm doubtful whether that'll happen. If there were pressure, a 50% improvement by 2050 could easily happen. And video conferencing, home banking, carpooling, sharing of cars could be encouraged to reduce car use. Cycling targets, which have quadrupled but for 2012, still lag far behind continental use. We don't take cycling very seriously in this country, and in cities people are deterred from bicycling because of the very high rate of fatal accidents, far higher than any other kind of fatal accident for bicyclists. To judge from the lackadaisical actions of the government, I doubt whether the 88% of carbon emissions which is required will be produced by 2050. But we are on target at the moment. But alas, I saw in today's paper that the European Union says that has warned that by 2008, European carbon dioxide emissions will have increased by 8% over the 1990 figure. So it won't have reduced, it will have increased, making the situation worse. So something is urgently needed to be done. Who knows, there is a recent report that bacteria might produce hydrogen from water. It is not an economic proposition, of course, it's only a scientific discovery. But if we had a hydrogen economy, we would then be blessed with an emission-free economy. However, that's still a pipe dream. I turn next to land. The issue here is a fair share of productive and sustainable land. First, we must note that the social and economic sustainability of human society depends on the retention of biodiversity, which is necessary to conserve the beauty of the landscape, to retain genetic resources, and the cultivation of new foods and medicines from plants. This is especially necessary as we are extinguishing so many species. 10% of the land needs to be protected or actively managed for biodiversity conservation. What is the situation at the moment? At present, 8% of the land is registered for SSSI, Sites of Special Scientific Interest. But over 800 of those 6,000 sites are presently under threat of damage. Under the European Habitats Directive, there should be a target of 10% of special areas of conservation. But only 5% of the UK area is at present so designated or even proposed. To achieve 10% will require a transfer of 50,000 acres from arable to protected status. Productive land is, of course, being gobbled up for urban areas. The physical size of cities in developing countries was expected to double between 1980 and 2000. I don't know whether it has. Some of the most fertile land is being lost to urban development. Higher urban densities are necessary to prevent urban sprawl. This might encourage people to walk instead of drive. It might enable an increase in car-free zones, since space for one car is equivalent to two rooms. Did you know that the housing density of London is only one-tenth of that of Barcelona? More conversions of larger houses into flats could be encouraged. Unfortunately, greenfield development is cheaper. There should be a tax on that such development. At the moment, VAT is payable on urban refurbishment, but not on new build. However, I think Mr. Prescott is getting this message. Most of the new building will be on brownfield sites. I reckon that by 2050, organic farming will be the rule. This would increase human health, encourage biodiversity, rural employment, and cut farming energy use by 60%. We don't as yet grow enough by this means. Much in the supermarkets are imported. There is at present a yield drop in organic produce of 20 to 30%. But this is partly due to the rejection of fruit and vegetables for cosmetic reasons. Every year, the organic yield improves. We may assume by 2010 a reduction of only 10% and by 2050 of 5%. In developing countries, the improvement will be more marked. Stocking densities of cattle will have to be dropped. Cattle, as well as grazing grass, consume enormous quantities of cereals and fish meal in their feeding stuffs. We import vast amounts of cereal, 4.5 million tons, for this purpose, which takes, incidentally, some 17,500 square kilometres to grow. In any case, there is a problem of disposal of food waste from cattle, which also emit 15% of our total methane gas, a very potent greenhouse gas, and meat from intensive farming uses 40% more energy than organic farming to produce. The UK currently uses 21.3 million hectares of land for all its food, for animals and for humans. This includes imported foods. With fair shares, our environmental space would allow us to use only 15.5 million, allowing for the fact that our agricultural land is more productive than that of most other lands. We need to reduce our use of land by one quarter, and for the interim target of 2010 by 7%. It's not very difficult to achieve. It will mean a shift from meat to vegetables, many more vegetables, grains and pulses, a lower meat diet, which is desirable anyhow on medical grounds. Reduction of animal foodstuffs will substantially reduce our demand for land for this use. Farming practices must change. Indeed, it could be said that is the silver lining of the present crisis of farming. Such changes resulting from the adoption of sustainable livestock farming and elimination of livestock product surpluses would greatly increase food availability for people. Yet in total, though there'd be more food for people, less land would be required. And our environmental space would still allow us to import fruit, sugar, coffee, tea, cocoa, nuts, etc. I realise I said nothing about fish, but I think we all know that fishing stocks are greatly depleted and the European Union is taking very strong steps to try to stop that. My time is running out. Let me talk briefly about wood. The reported rate of logging is 0.8% per annum of the total tropical forests. Terrible. Only a quarter of the tropical forests are now untouched by human hands. In order to preserve biodiversity, no more logging should be permitted in the old growth forests Replanting with new species is not the same. It alters the environment. As the wood production as a whole, 3/4 of it is consumed by northern countries, hardwoods. Global consumption is roughly the same now as the sustainable yield, but the FAO forecasts it will greatly increase by 2010. Our use in the UK is nearly 1 cubic meter per person, whereas the world average is 1/3 of a cubic meter per person. We consume 3% of world production. We have 1% of its population. Calculation of our environmental space shows that fair shares for the UK would result in cutting consumption by 3/4. How could this be done? In the first place, pre-consumer waste could be avoided by the use of thinnings, which comprise 50% of the annual crop. We're used for board manufacture, for structural building material, and the revival of coppicing would mean more employment. As for post-consumer wastes, the London Borough of Sutton, I don't know what they're doing. They've already achieved 23% of paper waste for recycling. They plan 50% by next year and 80% by the year 2006. If this happened throughout the UK, it would provide 10% of our paper production. Then we could substitute for paper, non-wood fibres, hemp, straw, flax and grass for paper making. This would produce the entire current writing paper consumption, though we would need 40 mills instead of the present 4. Excessive packaging could be reduced. Holland has managed to get 25% reduction in excessive packaging. A USA insurance office has eliminated 14 tons of paper by the use of screens and electronics. In the UK, offices have increased their use of paper by 10%. So 65% would be possible reduction in this way. Now, briefly, a look at metals and aggregates. In a sustainable economy, there would be no accumulation of metals in the biosphere. In other words, all metals would be recycled and there would be no extraction. Or at the very most, there would be no more than happens naturally through sedimentation and erosion. If that were the case, what happens naturally would mean a 50% reduction in our present use. In any case, mining produces much more waste than it does metal. As metals become rarer, waste will become greater. Already 1 ton of aluminium creates over 50 tons of waste, and aluminium accounts for 1% of the world's energy. Metal extraction accounts for 26% of total global toxic emissions, and the environmental problems arise through the dissipation of materials through the economic system. For instance, heavy metals pollute rivers. Recycling rather than mining resists this happening. When resources become too costly, substitutes can usually be found. For example, fibre optics instead of copper. We should probably plan for the maintenance of present resources for 50 years by balancing use with fresh finds and economies of use. Although, of course, by that time, oil, gas, coal and copper are likely to be exhausted in economic terms. Bearing in mind fair shares for all, this means a reduction of 50% over present usage of other metals, I suggested. In 1991, 7 countries, USA, South Korea, Japan, Germany, Italy, France, and the UK, containing 11% of the world's population, used 50% of aluminium, 43% of the world's crude steel, and 58% of the world's copper. Some of this, of course, is used as exported goods to the developing countries. In the UK, with 1% of the world's population, we are consuming 3.5% of the world's sustainable steel production and 5% of sustainable aluminium production. And then, of course, there are aggregates. We can't go on digging holes in the earth to produce virgin aggregates for construction work. At the moment, the UK only recycles 10%. Denmark, a small country of Denmark, recycles 80%. They care about these things. There is room for vast improvement here. As for steel, we export 3 to 4 million tons per annum. UK steel production is about 2% of world production. 90% of that is used here for vehicles and white goods or plant production. If all countries consumed in 2050 at the rate that Britain does now, we would need the resources of nearly six planets. For fair shares, we have to reduce by 20% by 2010, which could be achieved by increased recycling, product durability, substitution of modern materials. As for aluminium, if all countries consumed in 2050 at the rate that we are consuming now, we would need the resources of eight planets. Our consumption is increasing, but environmental space requires a reduction of 88% by 2050 and 24% by 2010. This could be done if we recycled our aluminium. We could recycle 90% of our discarded products. Generally speaking, we need reuse, repair, reconditioning and recycling of metals and minerals, and durability, and where possible, shared use. Well, there we are. I hope I haven't absolutely befogged you with statistics, but I felt I had to give some basis for what I was saying. We will have to come to this in the end, or catastrophe will face us. Urgent action is needed if we are to have sustainable development for the planet, with a fair share of resources, which retain for posterity the natural resources which all will be needed. Increasing global awareness is required, and great determination on the part of governments worldwide. What is first required is a sea change in public awareness. We must lead the way in taking action. We must put pressure on our government, even if few countries are yet doing so. Unless we do so, the green sentiments so often uttered by our politicians are so much moonshine. Scenarios I have suggested would suggest more employment, we would be a healthier, happier country, we could increase development and remain in a sustainable global economy. There I end.
Thank you very much. What a far-reaching presentation. I'm sure there are lots of questions.
I'm sure there will be.
What can we do in the schools to encourage our children to recycle? What action can be done in the school? Because it seems to me that this approach needs to start with the young people.
Well, obviously a lecture like this wouldn't be much good in a school, but I do think that the matter could be aired in schools, because it's going to vitally affect those who are now in their teens. Because by the time they're 60, they're going to be in a terrible catastrophic situation. Not. So I think it's very important that this should be aired in schools. What can be done? I'm not in the teaching profession. I don't know. But I think, first of all, arousing awareness among teachers in schools. Yes. Well, that's very good. But I think they need more definite statements, in a way, of what lies ahead. If we are going to have fair shares. But I think that if we don't have fair shares in the developing world, there'll be catastrophe anyhow, because they won't be able to, they won't take it. Still, that's another matter. I can't go into that. It's politics.
Go ahead.
Madam. I don't know. Are you? Do I take them as they come, or what?
You? It's up to you.
No, it's up to you. You're chairman.
Okay, well, we'll go here first. Yes.
Could you speak? I'm sort of old and deaf, so would you mind speaking up?
I too live in Camden, and some years ago we were joining the excitement of recycling, carrying things to the recycling depot of Camden, and carefully putting them into different bins. And on one occasion, when I left the compound, I spoke to the chappie at the gate, and he told me that what in fact happens is that they're all mixed together into a lorry, which dumps them. them into a hole in the ground somewhere.
Well, when
I said, how can that be? This is shameful. Said, well, madam, it's a problem. It's much more expensive to take them separately and use them for recycling. It's much cheaper to dump them in the ground, and the council doesn't have the money to do it, and the private sector doesn't do it because it's not as economical as other things. Now, you said rightly that the measures you proposed would also create additional employment,
yes,
which is very needed and very good. But then comes the question, who will pay for that employment? Can we achieve these wonderful things and very convincing things you mentioned without a radical strategy by government and the education system and ourselves to move away from the profitability, the primacy of profitability?
I think the answer to your last question is no. I don't see business doing things that's not profitable to do it, because they're in business to make a profit. But I don't know when you talked to your man at Camden. Was it last year? Or?
No, that was about 4 years ago.
Well, since then, John Selwyn Gummer introduced a tax on dumping. And I should be very disappointed if the present chancellor doesn't increase that dump, that tax on dumping, so that it doesn't become cheaper to dump it. The tax. And it's wholly true. It's difficult to get people to recycle, but it isn't wholly true. It's much more expensive. Otherwise, why should you find people using recycled paper? You often see on the bottom of a piece of paper, recycled paper. If it's for sale, they wouldn't buy it. It's much more expensive. It doesn't always look quite so nice there, I would agree. But I don't think you will get people to do this unless they can see that it's profitable. Why should a firm do something that's unprofitable? Do you see the point I'm making?
But what you're saying is to make it profitable, the government will have to tax the
landfill.
Alternative sources.
No, they'll have to tax landfill more.
Landfill,
yes, it's landfill.
That's about recycling, but every one of the things you mentioned, where one could achieve the savings and create more jobs, will it materialize if the public authorities say we can't pay for the jobs, and the private sector says, well, we get it cheaper without doing these additional activities?
No, I think that there will have to be... it has to be very carefully thought out how these things brought out. But I mean, you have a combined heat and warming system, you know, combined heat and warming system. That would need large capital costs, but those would be recouped in the end because it's a much cheaper system. And so there might need to be loan money to put them into practice, that kind of thing. Not given money, but loan money. That kind of thing would be needed. It certainly would mean a great upheaval in the farming industry, what I suggested. But, of course, it's beginning to happen on its own account now, because we can't... I mean, it's a blessing, in a way. We haven't been able to export all these cattle.
It'll be interesting to see what happens in the forthcoming budget. But over the last decade or 15 years, there's been, quite by accident, I'm sure, a massive shift away from taxing jobs, which we want more of, towards taxing consumption. VAT, for example, has shot up, and fuel prices, £1.07 of British government revenue will come from petrol taxation. These are not designed to change behaviour, they're designed to raise revenue and to win votes primarily, but by accident almost, the government has undertaken a sort of programme of eco-tax reform, which has long been argued for by many environmental groups. I think now, though, that as you were saying, that in the next budget he may abandon the fuel tax escalator and give in really in some ways to some powerful interest groups.
But thank you for raising a very important question.
What's the church of which you're so prominent a member doing to promote public awareness of this important ethical issue?
Lecturing in LSE. Well, you can't expect every bishop to be engaged in this area. We all have our own interests. I fought a losing battle with the church to try and get this high on its agenda. It's now a little higher than it was, but certainly not near the top as it should be. And for reasons that I gave at the beginning, I mean, it seems to me very strong theological reasons for it being top, but it's a failure of the church, I think, that it hasn't become more interested in this. It's very different in Germany. In Germany, every parish has a plan.
I agree with you that when nations such as China increase their level of economic development in the next couple of decades, if their level of development includes carbon dioxide emissions at the level of already developed countries like the UK, the USA, the world will be in a lot of trouble. I was disappointed recently to read about a group of people calling themselves the Global Climate Coalition in America, made up of oil producers and car manufacturers, who have somehow managed to mobilize American public opinion in a negative direction, convincing them that concerns about global warming are more myth than reality, and the subsequent effects on American political opinion, which seemingly has not implemented any of the agreements from Kyoto regarding carbon dioxide emissions. How can a country such as the UK hope to make an impact on things without a nation the size of the USA coming on board with this whole movement?
Very good question. I don't think I can answer it. I mean, it is vital that America should come on board, and indeed this global coalition, the climate coalition, actually prevented them coming aboard, and of course gave enormous quantities of money to for presidential campaigns and the like. President Clinton did want them to do it, but he failed. But they were too powerful. I don't know. I think at the end of the day, of course, America has been brought up on cheap fuel, and it's very... It's part of that, like, you know, you must have cheap fuel just as much as you must have guns. But I think at the end of the day, they probably will change if other people change. I don't know, though. I don't know what other people, what do you think? Do you think they're likely to? But I agree, it's a terrible problem. I mean, they are the greatest polluters, good heavens. They may be God's own country, but they don't behave like it. Thank you very much. Very good question. There is the new economic movement. What's it called? New economic movement
Foundation.
Or something, isn't it? Yes. And they're very concerned with the polluter paying and taxes in such a way that the polluter pays. And I think that's absolutely right. And we in the Friends of the Earth have been pressing that upon the Chancellor. But it's difficult to make much impact in these matters. But it isn't fair to say that the environmental movement isn't concerned with that. We are concerned with taxes which should be more concerned with paying for the pollution you cause than VAT on what you buy. As for social equity, it's very interesting that we, at any rate, the Friends of the Earth, have changed in the last 5 years considerably. We're now concerned with social equity as much as we are with that, because we believe it's important if we're going to have environmental space implemented. But I do think that various non-government organisations must concentrate on their primary objects. And there are lots of people involved in debt reduction, lots of organisations. You may remember that we had an enormous joined hands of the church all around Coventry, Birmingham, wasn't it, 2 years ago, and we actually achieved something in this way, so that, you know, debts have been, of the poorest nations now been, our Chancellor's promised to take them away. We support that, but we can't campaign on everything. I think that's how I'd answer. I'm talking about environmental organisation, we support it, but we can't put our main thrust there.
Because I was really talking about a deeper level of change. Cancelling debt doesn't actually address the problem of a debt-based system, particularly the banking system.
Oh, I see.
Changes in VAT
Yes.
If the
business is radically changed. I hear what you say. I didn't realize what that's what you meant. I think it's very difficult. You see, people are not going to produce things. They're going to make a profit from them. And that's to say with money. They're not going to lend money. We're producing money for people. And they're going to make a profit out of it. And that means that you have to pay interest. I don't think you can easily change that system. Though you can have preferential rates for certain types of people. Indeed, there are. But this is a little out of my area. I don't know. Perhaps you could answer that more easily.
Issues to do with EK tax reform, you know, the ones we were talking about a second ago, about shifting the tax base, have happened sort of by accident. They could go a lot further than they have done. Although actually the UK, as I was saying, probably by accident, is one of the leaders in that area just now and is developing new areas. The landfill tax, for example, the new climate change levy will have a massive impact on heavy industrial users of energy. And because it's complemented by a range of other measures to enable change as well as just to incentivize change, that it could have quite a dramatic effect. And the government, I think, has been very innovative in the way it's gone about that. Voluntary agreements, for example, that allow companies to get out of paying the tax if they commit themselves to drastic reductions in energy use. A new form of policy, but policy is becoming much more sophisticated and much more integrated. So rather than having an environment department that's there to mop up the after effects of every other department, you know, increasingly government is trying to instigate joined up thinking and to have more integrated approaches to policy, and fiscal reform is part of that. Strict liability is another major issue. But so far the banking system has been very good at opposing the imposition of strict liability, saying, well, if you hold us responsible for the people we lend to, then we'll just stop lending to them and the whole system will grind to a halt. So, you know, we'll take some political clout, I think.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, there's a chap here and then there's a lady there.
I would like to raise some objections to the system of distribution which you propose. It strikes me as very simplistic, advocating that you establish some sort of quantity of sustainable resources and then distribute those per capita. I mean, surely that neglects completely that there are different needs. I mean, there's countless examples of this. For instance, if you live in a more northern country, you're going to need to use more resources on the heat. I mean, it strikes me as an extremely simplistic model. And I mean, I don't even see how it could be implemented.
Yes, of course, energy for heating, I quite agree, is not needed in the tropics, but energy for other things is needed, isn't it? I just wonder what better system you can produce that's fair.
Actually, maybe I can comment on that slightly. As maybe you can tell from the temperature in here, the LSE now has an energy management system, which has saved 10% or so of energy use in buildings like this. And in new buildings are actually 40% more energy efficient than this one. Mm. And one of the things we've done with that system is to make them weather adjusted. So the performance indicators take into account weather and temperature as a way of measuring performance in different temperatures.
If I may say, it wasn't quite his point. His point is that he didn't like the idea of environmental space because it didn't think it was really equitable because some people don't need so much energy in the tropics. So that's what you were saying, wasn't it? Yeah, that's
but good. You might be able to adjust the measures for temperature. For
well,
example.
I can see there might be some alteration for temperature, but I cannot think of any fairer way of doing it.
Yeah, of course.
You're neglecting the whole issue of distribution by introducing such simplification.
Well, I don't think I am. I mean, distribution now is in the hands of developed countries, but other countries were to develop. They would just have good means of distribution. We tend to think of this as a sort of status quo where the rich people have, rich cultures can do all the distributing and so on. I'll give you a challenge. Produce a better system. Not now, necessarily. I think that's a bit off the cuff now. Yeah, you had a question. Sorry, could you speak up?
How big a part are the ethical banks beginning to emerge? For instance, the Triodos Bank, which I believe originated in Switzerland, but they've got a branch here now. Do you know it?
Child play.
Triodos. TRIODOS.
Oh, I've heard of this, yes, but I can't speak to it.
In terms of ethical investment, the largest company is French Friends Provident, and they it's less than 10% of Friends Provident. So, I mean, in terms of its proportion of the larger market, it's a tiny influence. Yeah, slowly. And one of the issues they've been grappling with is whether to only invest in positive companies, so to screen out the negative ones, or whether to actually actively engage with negative companies as a major investor and to try and change them. And I think moving towards that latter point where, you know, rather than just opting out and only investing in sustainable companies and instead engaging with oil companies even, is a more effective way of promoting change. They're so small relatively, I don't think they have much leverage, but yes, they are growing. And in the sort of alternative finance area, community credit schemes, particularly as mutual building societies dwindle and demutualize, community credit schemes are becoming much, much more significant. And they link in with a sort of shadow economy. It's interesting to think about how this affects what was said earlier in the week about tax dodges, about whether exchange trading schemes and essentially local barter schemes should be taxed in that way. So, I mean, it links into a whole area, but that whole area of alternative finance and alternative economic life has absolutely boomed in the last 5 or 6 years in the UK in many areas. And there are some people who think that it will grow dramatically because of collapse, actually. That major recession, for example, would encourage people not to opt out, downshifting in that sort of middle class sense, but actually will force a lot of people out. And they will then opt in, whether they like it or not, I think, to the alternative economy. So, the New Economics Foundation have been incredibly influential in that respect, looking at alternative lifestyles, really, and alternative economic systems.
Thank you. Perhaps it would be of interest here if I would just make a quotation from there. I won't say my Bible, my Apocrypha. The Triodos Bank in the Netherlands launched its two green investment funds during the 1980s to support organic agriculture and wind power. By astute political lobbying in the 1990s, it persuaded the Dutch government to establish tax breaks for such investment, which rapidly encouraged mainstream Dutch banks to follow suit. 7 certified funds now exist. They've proved massively popular. Rabobank's green fund had to be closed prematurely. It was oversubscribed more than 5 times within 2 weeks of opening, bringing in 430 million guilders instead of the expected 80. But mainstream banks in the UK are waiting for a lead from government. Similarly, financial analysts only pay limited attention to environmental performance of companies when advising on investment strategies. That's all.
Well, the Triodos Bank has got a branch here now.
Has it? Yes.
It obviously hasn't made a big noise. They're not spending a lot of money on advertising.
No, I think that's the case. Thank you very much. Thank you for raising it.
Perhaps at this point I could say that there's a reception after this lecture and we can discuss many of these issues further at that reception. It's in the senior dining room, which is upstairs to the 5th floor and then left a bit.
Well, there aren't copies, no. I mean,
If you have access to the internet, Friends of the Earth report is published on the internet. So if you go to the Friends of the Earth website, there's a whole lot of information.
I've got
on
a manuscript
there.
Here. Yeah.
Okay, well, it only remains for me to thank Bishop Montefiore for his time and effort and for giving such an interesting and stimulating presentation. Thank you very much.